as pride. Guy told us it was a record. "That's splendid," I said. "A proud achievement for the Howe family," he added, and you could see that he meant it. Howe had to put out a paper the next day, but Carmel offered to show me the sights. So late the next morning, we drove into the city to drop off my rental car and to do some shopping and have a look around. We were driving down Chapel Street, looking for a place to park, and Carmel was telling me about her work. She is the Melbourne correspondent for News International's other Australian papers, when she broke off and said brightly, "Oh, look, it's Jim Cairns." She indicated a little old man crossing the road in front of us, carrying a chair and a card table. He looked a little time-worn, but otherwise unremarkable. He was Deputy Prime Minister in the Whitlam government, she informed me. I looked at her to see if she was pulling my leg, but she smiled sincerely. "He sells his autobiography at that market over there." She indicated the sort of covered market where you would go to buy vegetables. I looked at her. "He sells books, his own book, from a card table." She smiled, cheerfully acknowledging that this might strike an outsider as just a trifle cheesy. "I suppose it's a way for him to make a little pocket money," she added. This was a man, you understand, who had not so long ago held the second highest office in the land. The equivalent in America, I suppose, would be to find Walter Mondale sitting at a card table in a mall in Minneapolis, selling White House coasters and other memorabilia. "He does this regularly," I asked. "Oh, he's a fixture. You want to meet him?" "Very much." We found a space and parked, but when we got to the market, we discovered that he had gone. Evidently, we had seen him on his way home. "I think things are sometimes a little slow for him," Carmel said sympathetically. "He's been selling the book for a long time." I nodded and reflected, not for the first time, what a strange, small, distant country Australia is. We were headed for the Immigration Museum, but our route took us past the new Crown Casino, a gaming palace that all Melbourne people either loathe because it's tacky and tempts foolish people to lose their savings, or adore because it's tacky and sometimes pays out big. "You want to have a look at it?" Carmel asked. I hesitated. I felt I had satisfied my gambling curiosity at the Penrith Panthers Club in Sydney on my first trip, but she said with unusual certitude, "I think it'll interest you," and we went in. She couldn't have been more right. It was an amazing place, vast in scale. It dwarfed by far even the Penrith Club, and dripping with ornate fixtures. Some kind of frantic laser show involving synthesized music and lots of drifting smoke, the better to show up the dancing beams, I guess, was taking place in a lofty outer atrium, but almost nobody was watching. The real business was in the casino beyond, which was no less extravagant in decor, and went on seemingly forever. I can say with confidence that whoever won the contract for the carpet at the Crown Casino has not had to work since. It took 20 minutes to stroll from one end of the room to the other. The amazing thing was its busyness and strange intensity. It was barely lunchtime, and perhaps 2,000 gamblers were already in devoted attendance. Hardly a pit or machine wasn't in fully active service. I had never seen anything on this scale outside Las Vegas, and in Las Vegas a good chunk of the people are just fooling around and having a good time. The people here were merely intent. At one roulette table I saw a man distribute perhaps 20 chips around the felt, lose them all, then reach into a wallet and pluck out 20 $50 bills to buy more. Quite slowly, for urban Australia is such a multicultural place that you scarcely notice these things normally, it dawned on me that he and the overwhelming proportion of other patrons were Chinese. I may have misjudged his attire, but he looked like a waiter or cook, certainly not like someone who could afford to lose thousands in a session. I mentioned this to Carmel, and she nodded. "Spectacular gamblers," she whispered. She gave a wan smile. "It's huge business. $1 billion a year goes through here. Victoria gets 15% of all its revenues from gambling." I thought for a moment. "That must be hundreds of millions of dollars. So how many casinos are there in the state?" I asked. "You're in it," she said. The Immigration Museum, just over the Yarra River, in a grand old edifice that was once the local customs house, provided a calm and decidedly more cerebral contrast. It had only recently opened and still gleamed with shiny newness. Hal had been particularly eager that I see it, because in his capacity as pillar of the community, he had been one of the driving forces behind its foundation. Since the immigrant experience is essentially the story of modern Australia, it was really a museum of social history, and quite the best one I have seen anywhere. In a cavernous central hall was a large walk-in display in the shape of an ocean liner, and designed, with the help of replica cabins and various ephemera, to convey the flavor of shipboard life for immigrants at different periods. I was particularly taken with the 1950s portion. I suppose because I grew up 1,000 miles from the sea and missed the great age of passenger liners, I've always been subject to a romantic longing for ocean travel. In any case, I found myself helplessly lingering over every trivial detail of shipboard life. Studying a 40-year-old menu as if I would soon be making my choice between lamb cutlets and braised beef, imagining my own books and toiletries on the shelf beside the bunk, thinking whether for the tea dancing this afternoon I should wear my baggage label shirt or go for a wild Orchids of Hawaii motif. I hadn't realized, or at least hadn't stopped to reflect in anything like an adequate manner, quite what an investment in both time and funds a trip to Australia represented in those days. Until as late as the early 1950s, a round-trip airplane ticket from Australia to England cost as much as a 3-bedroom suburban home in Melbourne or Sydney. With the introduction by Qantas of larger Lockheed Super Constellation airliners in 1954, prices began to fall. But even by the end of the decade, traveling to Europe by air still cost as much as a new car. Nor was it a terribly speedy or comfortable service. The Super Constellations took 3 days to reach London and lacked the power or range to dodge most storms. When monsoons or cyclones were encountered, the pilots had no choice but to put on the seatbelt signs and bounce through them. Even in normal conditions, they flew at a height guaranteed to produce more or less constant turbulence. Qantas called it, without evident irony, the kangaroo route. It was, by any modern measure, an ordeal. So for nearly every immigrant throughout the 1950s, a trip to Australia meant a 5-week sea cruise. Even now, of course, when you must allow yourself to be sealed into a wing canister for a full day in order to get there, Australia feels a long way away. But how infinitely remote it must have seemed when you stood on a ship's deck and watched the continents fall away one by one and measured out the distance in 12,000 miles of ship's wake. I studied the faces of the beaming people lounging on sunchairs or striding about on breezy decks. They wore expressions just like those on the faces of the people I'd seen in the Surfer's Paradise book in Adelaide. These people were happy too, radiantly so. They were on their way to a lucky country, and they knew it. Awaiting them was a life of abundant sunshine, and good jobs, good homes, good prospects, and electric jugs for all. They were going on a vacation, and they were going forever. It was such an interesting age for Australia. It wasn't just millions of foreigners who became Australian in the 1950s, but, in an odd way, Australians themselves. I had only just learned that until 1949, there was no such thing as Australian citizenship. People born in Australia were not in any technical sense Australians at all, but Britons, as British as if they were from Cornwall or Scotland. They swore allegiance to king and country, and when Britain went to war, they unhesitatingly went off to die in foreign fields for her. At school, they studied British history, geography, and economics as assiduously as if they were growing up in Liverpool or Manchester. I remember in one of her letters, Catherine Veitch remarking to me on the surreal quality of sitting in an Adelaide classroom in the 1930s, looking out on blazing waratah trees and flocks of kookaburras or whatever, while learning the heights of Scottish mountains or the figures for barley production in East Anglia. The absurdity of the situation wasn't lost on Australians, but Britain was all they had. As the historian Alan Moorhead once wrote, "Australians of my generation grew up in a world apart. Until we went abroad, we had never seen a beautiful building, hardly ever heard a foreign language spoken, or been to a well-acted play, or eaten a reasonably sophisticated meal, or listened to a good orchestra." The oddest aspect of all was that millions of Australians, most of whom had never left the country, went through life thinking of England in some odd, ultimate sense as home. As late as 1957, in On the Beach, the Neville Shute novel in which a nuclear war leaves Australia as the last inhabited place on Earth, the author could have his Australian heroine lament, "I was going home in March, to London. It's been arranged for years. It's so bloody unfair." By home, she means a country she has never seen, and now never will. But even as Shute wrote, Australia was in the process of becoming a very different country. In World War II, it had suffered a kind of blunt trauma when, after the fall of Burma and Singapore, Britain pulled out of the Far East, leaving Australia suddenly alone and dangerously exposed. At the same time, Winston Churchill, a man whose presumptuousness was never less than enthralling, asked Australia's military leaders to divert their troops to India, in effect, to abandon their wives and children and fight for the greater good of empire. The Australians decided they could not. Instead, they stayed behind and fought a rear-guard action to try to stop the Japanese advance across New Guinea. Not many people outside Australia realized just how close the Japanese got. They had captured most of the Solomon Islands and much of New Guinea, just to the north, and seemed poised for an invasion. The Australian military, knowing the position was hopeless, drew up a plan to fall back to the southeast corner of the country, sacrificing nearly the whole of the continent in the hope of defending the main cities. It could have been no more than a delaying tactic. Luckily, the tide of battle moved elsewhere after the American naval victory at Midway, and Australia was reprieved. Australia escaped, but it was left with two scars: a realization that Britain could not be counted on to come to its rescue in a crisis, and a sense of immense vulnerability to the teeming and unstable countries to the north. Both of these matters deeply influenced Australian attitudes in the post-war years, indeed still do. Australia became seized with the conviction that it must populate or perish, that if it didn't use all that empty land and fill all those empty spaces, someone from outside might do it for them. So in the years after the war, the country threw open its doors. In the half-century after 1945, its population soared from 7 million to 18 million. Britain alone couldn't provide the necessary bodies, so people were welcome from all over Europe, particularly Greece and Italy in the immediate post-war years, making the nation vastly more cosmopolitan. Suddenly, Australia was full of people who liked good wine and good coffee and olives and eggplants, and realized that spaghetti didn't have to be a vivid orange and come from cans. The whole warp and rhythm of life changed. Good neighbor councils were established everywhere to help the immigrants settle and feel welcomed, and the Australian Broadcasting Corporation offered English language courses, which were enthusiastically taken up by tens of thousands. By 1970, the country could boast of 2.5 million new Australians, as they were known. Of course, it wasn't perfect. In the fever to populate, some migrants were accepted with less reflection than might have been wished. At least 10,000 children, many as young as four, were dispatched from British orphanages between 1947 and 1967 by child welfare groups like the Salvation Army, Barnardos, and the Christian Brothers. The impulse was genuinely altruistic. It was felt that the children would have a chance of a better life in a country that was warm and sunny and needed labor. But the execution often lacked subtlety. Siblings were frequently parted, never to meet again, and many of the children had essentially no notion of what was happening to them. In his book Orphans of the Empire, Alan Gill notes how one little boy, seeing a sign announcing the mustering point for the Barnardo's party, was thrilled because he presumed party meant cake and ice cream. Another inquired, as the ship made its way up the Thames, whether they would be home in time for tea. Stories don't get a great deal more poignant than that. There was also the deep odium of the White Australia policy, which allowed immigration officials to keep out undesirables by requiring them to pass a literacy test in any European language of the authorities' choosing, including, on one famous occasion, Scottish Gaelic, and to deport non-whites with little thought of compassion. In the early 1950s, Arthur Calwell, the Minister for Immigration, tried to repatriate the Indonesian-born widow and eight children of an Australian citizen. If Australians have a single radiant virtue, it is the belief in a fair go, a sense of the fundamental rightness of common justice, and the case caused an outcry. The courts told Caldwell to get real, and the more insensitive side of the exclusion policy swiftly began to erode. Around 1970, as Australia increasingly recognized that it was, at least geographically, an Asian nation and not a European one, the color bar came down and hundreds of thousands of immigrants were let in from across the region. Today, Australia is one of the most multicultural countries on earth. A third of the people in Sydney were born in another country. In Melbourne, the four most common surnames are Smith, Brown, Jones, and Nguyen. Across the country as a whole, almost a quarter of the people have no British antecedents on either side of their families. For millions of people, it truly was a chance of a new life. One that, on the whole, was generously extended and gratefully accepted. In a single generation, Australia completely remade itself. It went from being a half-forgotten outpost of Britain, provincial, dull, and culturally dependent, to being a nation infinitely more sophisticated, confident, interesting, and outward-looking. And it did all this, by and large, without discord or disturbance or serious mistakes, indeed often with a kind of grace. By coincidence, a few nights earlier, I had watched a television documentary about the immigrant experience in the 1950s. One of the people interviewed was a man who had arrived from Hungary as a teenager after the uprising there. On his first full day in the country, he had gone, as instructed, to the local police station and explained in halting English that he was a new immigrant who had been told to register his address. The sergeant had stared at him for a moment, then risen from his seat and come around the desk. The Hungarian recalled that for one bewildered moment he thought the policeman might be about to strike him, but instead the sergeant thrust out a meaty hand and said warmly, "Welcome to Australia, son." The Hungarian recalled the incident with wonder even now, and when he finished there were tears in his eyes. "I tell you sincerely, it's a wonderful country." Chapter 11. Carmel Egan grew up on a farm in eastern Victoria, on the southern edge of the Great Dividing Range, in lovely country of green fields set against a backdrop of blue hills. Howe, a lifelong city boy whose notion of the bush was of a monotonous expanse filled with deathly creatures, had gone to visit the family farm out of a sense of husbandly duty, and fallen for it at once. So much so that he and Carmel had bought a parcel of land high on a neighboring hillside, trucked in a jaunty wooden cottage, and placed it in a lofty spot giving views over miles of hills, woods, and farms. Howe had been telling me about it with a certain repetitive rapture for years, and was keen for me to see it. So the next day, after loading up with provisions, we set off in their car for the 3-hour drive to their rural idyll. Bush is such a vague word in Australia that I wasn't sure what to expect, but it became obvious once we had shrugged off the outer suburbs of Melbourne that eastern Victoria was a favoured corner of the world, greener than any part of Australia I had seen before, and backed by mountains that attained a wholly respectable eminence. The road wound through meadowy landscapes in a charmingly indecisive manner, and through a succession of small and pleasant towns. With strange, unshakable pride, Howe wore an arrestingly outsized and touchingly misguided bush hat he had lately acquired, which inclined Carmel and me, when we stopped for gas or coffee, to signal to staring strangers that he was out on a visit and we'd be taking him back to the home at the end of the week. But otherwise the journey passed without incident or embarrassment. Alan and Carmel's house stands in glorious seclusion on the brow of a steep hill. The view, over a forgotten valley of tobacco fields and scattered vineyards, was expansive and charming in a way that brought to mind a children's picture book. This was, I realized after a minute, the view from the top of the beanstalk. "Not bad, eh?" said Howe. "Much too good for anyone in a hat like that. What's this area called?" "The King Valley. Carmel's old man used to farm over there." He pointed to a rolling piece of land nestled against a neighboring hill. It recalled, almost impossibly, the landscapes of Grant Wood, gumdrop hills, rolling fields, plump trees, which depicted an idealized Iowa that never actually existed. It existed here. Hal led us into the house, and he and Carmel immediately began moving about in an impressively practiced manner, opening windows, putting on the water heater, packing away groceries. I helped carry stuff in from the car, watching for snakes with every step, and when that was finished, stepped onto the broad deck to take in the view. Hal came out after a minute, bearing two cold beers, one of which he passed to me. I don't believe I had ever seen him looking so relaxed. Mercifully, he had removed the hat. He took a sip of beer, then said in an anecdotal tone, "When I first met Carmel, she used to talk about one day buying a piece of land out here and putting a house on it. And I thought, yes, dear. I mean, why would you want to own a house in the middle of the bush with all the costs and dangers of bushfires and everything? And then one day we came up to visit her family, and I took one look and I said, right, where do I sign? Not long after that, the family sold up and moved to Ballarat, so we bought this corner of the property, which they were happy to sell because it's too steep to farm, and had the house put up. He nodded at Carmel, humming away in the kitchen. She loves it here. So do I, come to that. I never thought I'd say I loved the country, but geez, you know it's a nice place to get away to. Are bushfires a big worry? Well, they are when they happen. Sometimes they're colossal. Gum trees just want to burn, you know. It's part of their strategy, how they outcompete other plants. They're full of oil, and once they catch fire, they're a bugger to put out. You get a really big bushfire moving across the landscape at 50 miles an hour, with flames leaping 150 feet in the air, and it's an awesome sight, believe me. How often does that happen? Oh, I suppose every 10 years or so you get a really big one. There was one in 1994 that burned 600,000 hectares and threatened parts of Sydney. I was there at the time, and in one direction there was this pall of black smoke that completely filled the sky, burned for days. The biggest one ever was in 1939. People still talk about that one. It was during a heat wave so bad that department store mannequins' heads actually started to melt in the windows. Can you imagine that? That one burned up most of Victoria. So how much at risk are you here? He shrugged philosophically. It's all in the lap of the gods. Could be next week, could be 10 years from now, could be never. He turned to me with an odd smile. You are totally at the mercy of nature in this country, mate. It's just a fact of life. But I tell you one thing. What's that? It sure makes you appreciate something like this when you know it could all go up in a puff of smoke. Hal is one of those people who can't stand to see anyone sleeping when there is daylight to be utilized, and he rousted me out early the next morning with the announcement that he had a busy day planned for us. For a terrible moment, I thought he meant we were going to shingle the roof or dig up boulders or something, but then he noted that we were going to have a Ned Kelly day. Hal was immensely proud that Kelly came from this part of Victoria and wanted to show me several of the sights connected with his short and brutish life. This sounded somewhat more promising. It is an interesting fact, and one that no doubt speaks much about the Australian character, that the nation never produced a law enforcement hero along the lines of Wyatt Earp or Bat Masterson in America. Australian folk heroes are all bad guys of the Billy the Kid type, only here they are known as bushrangers. And the most famous of them all was Ned Kelly. The story of Kelly is easily told. He was a murderous thug who deserved to be hanged, and was. He came from a family of rough Irish squatters who made their living by stealing livestock and waylaying innocent passers-by. Like most bushrangers, he was at pains to present himself as a champion of the oppressed, though in fact there wasn't a shred of nobility in his character or his deeds. He killed several people, often in cold blood, sometimes for no very good reason. In 1880, after years on the run, Kelly was reported to be holed up with his modest gang, a brother and two friends, in Glen Rowan, a hamlet in the foothills of the Warby Range in northeastern Victoria. Learning of this, the police assembled a large posse and set off to get him. As surprise attacks go, it wasn't terribly impressive. When the police arrived, on an afternoon train, they found that word of their coming had preceded them, and that 1,000 people were lined up along the streets and sitting on every rooftop eagerly awaiting the spectacle of gunfire. The police took up positions and at once began peppering the Kelly hideout with bullets. The Kellys returned the fire, and so it went throughout the night. The next dawn, during a lull, Kelly stepped from the dwelling, dressed unexpectedly in a suit of armor of his own devising, a heavy cylindrical helmet that looked strikingly like an inverted bucket, and a breastplate that covered his torso and crotch. He wore no armor on his lower body, so one of the policemen shot him in the leg. Aggrieved, Kelly staggered off into some nearby woods, fell over, and was captured. He was taken to Melbourne, tried, and swiftly executed. His last words were, "Such is life." Not exactly the stuff of legend, one would have thought, yet in his homeland Kelly is treated with deep regard. Sidney Nolan, one of Australia's most esteemed artists, did a famous series of paintings devoted to Kelly's life, and books abound on the subject. Even serious historians often accord him an importance that seems to the outsider curiously disproportionate. Manning Clark, for example, in his one-volume History of Australia, devotes just a paragraph to the design and foundation of Canberra, dispenses with Federation in 2 pages, but gives a full 9 pages to the life and achievements of Ned Kelly. He also allows Kelly some of his most florid and incoherent prose, which is saying a great deal, believe me. Manning Clark is an extraordinary stylist at the best of times, a man who would never call the moon, when he might instead call it the lunar orb. But with Kelly he was inspired to lofty allusions and cosmic musings of a rare impenetrability. Here is a small part of his description of Kelly's fateful emergence from the compound after the night-long shootout. In the half-light before that red disk, i.e. the sun, appeared again on the eastern horizon, a tall figure, encased in armor, came out of the mists and wisps of frosty air. Some thought it was a madman or a ghost. Some thought it was the devil, the whole atmosphere having stimulated in friend and foe alike a superstitious awe. Personally, and this is just a stab in the dark, I think Manning Clark was taking way too much codeine. Here's another of his well-juiced creations, this the merest fragment of a much longer passage discussing Kelly's legacy. He lived on as a man who had confronted the bourgeois calm-down with all the uproar of a magnificent Dionysian frenzy, a man who had taken down the mighty from their seat and driven the rich empty away. He lived on as a man who had savaged policemen in the old convict tradition and denounced the brutal barbarism of those who clothed their sadism toward the common people in the panoply of the law. About 2,800 milligrams talking there, I would say. Today, Glenrowan is a one-street town with a couple of pubs, a scattering of houses, and a short strip of enterprises dedicated to extracting a little cash from the Kelly legend. On this hot summer's day, there were perhaps a dozen visitors in town, including Alan Carmel and me. The biggest of the commercial enterprises, a place called Ned Kelly's Last Stand, was covered in painted signs of a semi-professional quality. "This is not a place for wimps," said one, promisingly. Another added, "It is absolutely absurd that after allowing yourself 10 to 20 minutes to take photos, walk up and down the street, and buy some souvenirs, and then have the audacity to tell your friends, 'Don't go to Glenrowan, for there is nothing to see.' To be quite honest, most visitors to Glenrowan wouldn't know if the country shithouse fell on them." The impression one derived from further study was that it contained some kind of animatronic show. Alan Carmel and I exchanged happy looks and knew that this was a place for us. Inside, a friendly man presided over a cash register. We were mildly staggered to see that they wanted $15 a head for admission. "It's good, is it?" said Hal. "Mister," said the man with the greatest sincerity, "it's like Disneyland in there." We bought tickets and shuffled through a door into a dim room where the spectacle was to begin. The space was designed to look like an old saloon. In the middle were benches for the audience. Before us, in a deep gloom, we could just make out the shapes of furniture and seated dummies. After a few minutes, the lights dimmed altogether. There was a sudden very loud bang of gunfire, and the performance began. "Well, call me a wimp, drop a brick shithouse on me, but I can honestly say that I have never seen anything so wonderfully, so delightfully, so monumentally bad as Ned Kelly's Last Stand. It was so bad it was worth every penny. Actually, it was so bad it was worth more than we paid. For the next 35 minutes, we proceeded through a series of rooms where we watched homemade dummies, each with a frozen smile and a mop of hair that brought to mind wind-blown pubis, reenacting various scenes from the famous Kelly shootout in a random and deliriously incoherent way. Occasionally, one of them would turn a stiff head or jerk up a forearm to fire a pistol, though not necessarily in sync with the narrative. Meanwhile, around each room, lots of other mechanical events were taking place. Empty chairs rocked, cupboard doors mysteriously opened and shut, player pianos played. A figure of a boy on a trapeze, and why not, swung back and forth amid the rafters. Do you know those fairground stalls where you fire a rifle at assorted targets to make an outhouse door swing open or a stuffed chicken fall over? Well, this reminded me of that, only much worse. The narrative, insofar as it could be heard above the competing noises, made no sense at all. When at last we were liberated into the sunshine, we were so delighted that we considered going in again. But $45 is a lot of money, after all, and we feared that with repeated exposure it might begin to make some sense. So instead we went and looked at a giant fiberglass Ned Kelly that stood outside one of the souvenir shops. It wasn't as big or as intimidating as the Big Lobster, and its testicles didn't swing in the breeze, but it was still a game stab at the genre. Then we had a look around a couple of the shops and bought some postcards and returned to the car for the next part of our day's adventure. This was to see the famous Kelly tree at a remote spot called Stringy Bark Creek. This involved a long drive into a strange, spooky valley of abandoned and semi-abandoned farms, nearly all of them half buried under blackberry brambles, then up into dense and verdant rainforest, and finally into crowded groves of towering stringy bark trees. Australia has some 700 varieties of eucalyptus trees, and they have the most wonderfully expressive names. Kakadu woolly butt, bastard tallowwood, gimpy messmate, candlebark, ghost gum. But the stringy bark was the first that I could identify by sight. The bark peels off in long strips and hangs from the branches in fibrous tassels, or lies in curled heaps on the ground, all the better to burn, apparently. It was a handsome tree, too, tall, straight, and very close-growing. Some miles into the woods we came to a parking area, beside a sign announcing the Kelly tree. We were the only visitors. It felt as if we might have been the only visitors in years. The forest was cool and noiseless, and with all the strands of bark hanging down, it had a strange, unwelcoming, otherworldly feel. The Kelly tree stood along a path through the woods, distinguished from the others by the stoutness of its trunk and by a metal plaque in the shape of Kelly's famous helmet. "And what is the Kelly tree exactly?" I asked. "Well," Alan said with a learned air, "as the Kelly gang got more and more notorious, the police started hunting them with greater determination, and so they had to hide out in increasingly remote and desperate places, such as here." He gave a nod of assent. "Can't get much lonelier than this." We took a moment to consider our surroundings. Because of the thickness with which the stringy barks grew beside each other, there was almost no space to stretch out or move around, and the air had a kind of dank, organic closeness. It was, I think, the least bucolic forest I have ever been in. Even the light seemed stale. "For 3 years," Alan went on, "Kelly and his gang laid low. But in 1878, four policemen tracked them here. Somehow Kelly and his men captured and disarmed the policemen. Then they murdered three of them in a slow and pretty horrible way." "Horrible in what way?" I asked, ever alert for the morbid detail. "Shot them in the balls and let them bleed to death, to maximize the pain and indignity." "And the fourth policeman?" "Scarpered. He hid overnight in a wombat's burrow, and the next day he made his way back to civilization and raised the alarm. So it was the murder of three men here that led eventually to the shootout at Glen Rowan, as so memorably depicted for us by the robotic wonders of Ned Kelly's Last Stand." "So how come you know so much about all this?" He looked at me with a hint of disappointment. "Because I know a great deal about many things, Bryson." "You haven't got a clue about hats, though," said Carmel cheerfully. He looked at her and decided that this was a comment not to be dignified with a response, then turned back to me. "Now to Power's Lookout," he announced with a certain resolve, and set off in a stately tramp for the car. "And how many more Kelly sites will we be visiting?" I called, trying not to betray too much alarm, as I followed him through the woods. I wish no disrespect to Australia's most treasured thug, or to imply any disappointment at all in the Kelly tree. Quite the reverse. But we did seem to be hours from anywhere, and fast approaching that time of day when one begins to think about the convivial possibilities of food and drink. "Just one more, and it's on the way home, and you won't regret it, and then we'll have a pint." He was as good as his word. Power's Lookout was fabulous. A platform of rock hanging high in the sky, it was named for Harry Powers, another storied bushranger, who sometimes shared the view with Kelly and his gang. Some diligent crew had built sturdy wooden walkways up and around the craggy rocks, making it a simple, if slightly taxing, matter to get from the main body of the cliff to the rocky outcrop that was the lookout. The view was sensational. Perhaps 1,000 feet below spread the King Valley, a snug and tidy realm of small farms and white farmhouses. Beyond, across air of flawless clarity, rose waves of low mountains, culminating in the distinctive hump of Mount Buffalo, some 50 kilometers away. "You know, if you put this in Virginia or Vermont," I mused, "there would be scores of people here, even at this hour. There'd be souvenir stands and probably an IMAX screen and an adventure park." Howe nodded. "It'd be the same in the Blue Mountains. It's like I've been telling you. This corner of Victoria is a great secret. Don't put it in your book." "Certainly not," I replied sincerely. "And wait till you see what we've got for you tomorrow. It's even better." "Not possible," I said. "No, it is. It's even better." What he had for us the next day was a place called Alpine National Park, and in fact it was even better. Covering 2,500 square miles of eastern Victoria, it was lofty, grand, cool, and green. If ever there was a portion of Australia remote from all the clichéd images of red soil and baking sun, this was it. They even skied here in winter. Alpine is perhaps a somewhat ambitious term. You will find no craggy Matterhorns here. The Australian Alps have a gentler profile, more like the Appalachians of America or the Scottish Cairngorms. But they do attain entirely respectable heights. Kosciuszko, the tallest, tops out at something over 7,000 feet. Howe, through one of his contacts, had gotten hold of a friendly and helpful warden named Ron Riley, who had agreed to show us around his airy domain. A genial man with a dapper gray beard, Ron had the lean bearing and far-off gaze of someone whose world is the out-of-doors. We met in the little town of Mount Beauty, where we decanted into one of the park's four-wheel drive vehicles, and set off on the long twisting drive up Mount Bogong, Victoria's highest peak at 6,500 feet, about the same height as Mount Washington in New Hampshire. I asked him if Mount Bogong was named for the famous Bogong moths, which erupt in vast, fluttery multitudes every spring, and for a day or two seem to be everywhere. Along with plump witchetty grubs and long, slimy mangrove worms, they are the delicacies of the Aboriginal diet most often noted by chroniclers. Noted because, of course, they are so unappealing to the Western palate. The bogongs are roasted in hot ashes and eaten whole, or so I had read. Ron acknowledged that this was where they came from. "And the Aborigines really eat them?" "Oh, yeah. Well, traditionally, anyway. A bogong moth is 85% fat, and they didn't get a lot of fat in their diet, so it was quite a treat for them. They used to come from miles." "Have you ever eaten one?"
"Once," he said.
"And?"
"Once was enough." He smiled.
"What did it taste like?"
He thought for a moment.
"Like a moth."
I grinned. "I read that it has a kind of buttery taste."
He thought about that.
"No, it has a moth taste."
We climbed up a steep, winding road through dense groves of an amazingly tall and beautiful tree. Ron told me they were mountain ashes. I made an appropriately appreciative face.
I didn't know you had ashes here, I said. We don't. They're eucalypts. I looked again, surprised. Everything else about it, its long straight body, its height, its lushness, was completely at odds with the skeletal gums associated with the lowlands. It really was true that the eucalypts have filled every ecological niche in Australia. There never was a more various tree. Tallest tree in the world after the California redwoods, Ron added with a nod at the ashes, causing me to make another appreciative face. How tall do they grow? Up to 300 feet. They average about 200. 300 feet is about the height of a 25-story building. Big trees. Do you get many bushfires? Ron gave a regretful nod. Sometimes. We lost 500,000 hectares in this part of the Great Dividing Range in 1985. Gosh, I said, though the figure meant little to me. Later I looked in a book and discovered that 500,000 hectares is equivalent to the area covered by Yosemite, Grand Teton, Zion, and Redwood National Parks. In other words, it was a natural disaster on a scale almost inconceivable in other countries. I also looked in the New York Times index to see what coverage it had been given. None. Even without being able to conceive quite what 500,000 hectares is, I knew, of course, that it was a lot, so I added politely, "That must have been awful." Ron nodded again. "Yeah, it was a bit," he said. We passed through a zone of snow gums, yet another niche dominated by the versatile eucalypts, and emerged into a sunny world of high, gently undulant plains, covered everywhere in pale grass and spongy alpine plants, with long views to distant summits. Quite a few visitors were evident, most of them with the springy step and considered apparel of the serious walker. At every group we passed, Ron slowed with the window down and said good day, and asked if they had everything they needed in the way of information. They always did, but it seemed an unusually welcoming gesture. And then we had the most marvelous day. Sometimes we stopped and walked a little, and the rest of the time we drove. The weather was gorgeous, cool at these heights, but sunny, and Ron was droll and good-natured. He knew every leaf and bud and insect, and seemed genuinely to enjoy showing off all the secret corners of the park. We bumped along overgrown tracks through meadowy vales, and skittered up near perpendicular gravel roads to hidden fire towers. At every turn there was a point of interest or a memorable view. Alpine National Park is immense, about three times the size of the Great Smoky Mountains National Park in America, but it is actually vaster still, because it is contiguous along its eastern border with the even larger Kosciuszko National Park in the Snowy Mountains, just over the border in New South Wales. Ron pointed out Kosciuszko, Kosci, he called it, almost exactly 100 kilometers away, but I couldn't see it, even with binoculars. We finished the day at an imposing eminence called Mount Mackay, where there were yet more top-of-the-world views, range upon range of steep hills rolling away to a far-off horizon. He took in the view with the assessing gaze of someone watching for a telltale plume of smoke. "So how much of all this are you responsible for?" I asked. 100,000 hectares, he replied. "A lot of ground," I said, thinking of the responsibility. "Yeah," he replied, squinting thoughtfully at the vista before us. "I'm very lucky." It would, of course, take something extremely exceptional to match Glenrowan and Powers Lookout and Alpine National Park, and frankly I'm not sure that many other countries could have provided it. But Howe assured me that he had one last special something for us to see, something that existed nowhere else in the world but in one small corner of Victoria. Beyond that he would not be drawn. The next day, to add to the savor of pleasure deferred, we went to a sleepy, old-fashioned coastal resort called Lake's Entrance, where we stopped for the night and had a nice seafood supper and a shuffle around, and the day after set off for our mystery attraction en route to Melbourne. For quite a spell we drove through flat, sunny, uneventful farming country, and I sat in the back in a state of tranquil mindlessness, when abruptly Alan steered the car off the highway beside a large sign I couldn't see well enough to read, and parked in a large and mostly empty parking lot. I unfolded myself from the back seat and stepped blinking from the car. Beside us was a long tubular building, rather like a very large cloche, but made of concrete and painted white. I looked questioningly at Hal. "The giant worm," he announced. I stared at him in wonder and admiration, not as in the famous giant worms of southwest Gippsland. "The same," he said. "You're familiar with them, then." I gave the hollow laugh that such a question deserved. I'd been reading about these behemoths of the underworld for months, albeit mostly in footnotes and other passing references. I had never expected to find a shrine to them. Even in a land of extraordinary creatures, the giant worms of Gippsland are exceptional. Called Megascalides australis, they are the world's largest earthworms, growing up to 12 feet in length and more than 6 inches in diameter. So substantial are they that you can actually hear them moving through the earth with a gurgling sound like bad plumbing. What it is about this one small corner of Victoria that led to the evolution of extremely outsized worms is a question that science has yet to answer. But then, it must be said, very few of the world's best minds are drawn to the questions of earthworm physiology and distribution. However, Hal promised, such knowledge as the world holds was contained within the tubular structure before us. We procured 3 tickets and stepped eagerly into the display areas. On the wall facing us as we entered was a blown-up photograph taken early in the century, showing 4 ridiculously pleased-looking men holding a droopy 12-footer, little thicker than a normal earthworm, but clearly ambitious in the length department. This I studied with great interest, until Carmel drew my attention to a display of living giant worms. These were in a large glass panel, half an inch thick and filled with earth, rather like a very large ant farm, which hung on the wall. According to a label, the case contained a pair of giant worms. In a couple of spots where the earth had come away from the glass, we could see a millimeter or two of living giant worm, but as they weren't moving or doing anything, Megascalides is extremely devoted to rest, it seems. The experience was, I confess, a trifle anticlimactic. I had rather hoped there would be a petting corner, or perhaps a tamer with a whip and a chair, getting them to go through hoops. Alan and I tried to enliven the worm by tapping lightly on the glass, but it declined to respond. Beside the panel were 2 long glass tubes filled with formaldehyde and containing a pair of preserved giant worms, each of normal earthworm circumference, but about 4 or 5 feet long. Not exactly titans, but long enough to impress. Worms don't preserve terribly well, and the formaldehyde had horrible little bits of worm skin floating in it, as if someone had been shaking the tubes, or, more probably, as Alan and I conclusively established by tapping on them, by tapping on them. It was hard to look at them without growing a little queasy. In the next room was a short film that told all that was known about the giant earthworm, which is to say, almost nothing. They are reclusive, delicate, not terribly numerous, and deeply uncooperative creatures, and thus not easy to study, even assuming you had a mind to. As you may recall from childhood experiments, earthworms really don't wish to come out of their holes, and if you pull, they tend to snap. Well, imagine trying to tug a 12-foot long worm out of its burrow. Nearly impossible. The one thing the Giant Worm Museum establishes beyond question is that you can only get so much mileage out of giant worms. Recognizing this, the proprietors had provided many other displays. Next door were some glass cases containing live snakes, including the famous and fearsome taipan, Australia's deadliest snake. Alan and I conducted some further glass-tapping experiments, then retreated 4 yards together in a platonic embrace when the taipan snarled at us, or possibly just yawned, opening its jaws wide enough to swallow a human head, or so it seemed. Deciding that henceforth we would keep our hands in our pockets, we followed Carmel outdoors where there was a compound containing yet more animals, kangaroos and emus, a forlorn-looking dingo, some caged cockatoos, 6 curled and dozing wombats, and a couple of koalas, also dozing. It was a very hot, still afternoon, and evidently siesta time, so the enclosures had an air of profound inertness. Even the cockatoos slept. But I strolled among them with fascination, delighted to see so much native exotica brought together in one place. I peered with particular interest at the wombats. A squat, thick, short-legged, and rather inactive quadruped, with great appearance of stumpy strength, as the first Englishman to see one, recorded in 1788, in words that could not be bettered. The same man was a little less reliable with the kangaroo, which he described as a small bird of beautiful plumage. Alan and Carmel looked on with the tolerant amusement with which an American might view a display of raccoons and chipmunks, for most of these were animals that they saw regularly in their natural state. But to me, every one was a novelty, even the dingo, which is, after all, just a dog. I made two complete circuits of the menagerie. Then, with a look of satisfaction, I gave a nod, and we set off once again for Melbourne. We went out to dinner at a Vietnamese restaurant in the inner Melbourne suburb of Richmond, on a street lined seemingly for miles with exotic restaurants, and Alan made the point, with which I could not argue, that Melbourne is an infinitely better city than Sydney for dining out. In the course of conversation, Alan asked if I was going to the Great Barrier Reef, a place for which he had a special fondness. I said I wasn't on this trip, but I was when I came back in a few weeks. "Just be careful they don't leave you out there," he gave a thin smile. "What do you mean?" I asked. "There was a story here recently. One of the dive companies left an American couple out on the reef." "Left them?" I said, puzzled but intrigued. Hal nodded and speared at some pasta. "Yeah, it miscounted somehow and went back to port 2 passengers short. Bit of a pisser for the people left behind, wouldn't you say? I mean, one minute you're swimming around looking at coral and fish, having the time of your life, and then you surface and discover that the boat is gone and you're all alone in a very large and empty ocean." "They couldn't swim to shore?" I asked. He smiled tolerantly at my ignorance. "Barrier Reef's a long way out, Bryson, something over 30 miles where they were. Long way to swim." "And there were no islands or anything?" "Not where they were. They were effectively out to sea. Apparently there were a couple of things they could swim to, a big moored pontoon that the dive company used, and some kind of a coral atoll, both a couple of miles away." So, presumably muttering oaths and understandably feeling a little hard done by, they started swimming towards those. What they didn't know, couldn't know, was that they were swimming across a deep water channel. And guess what lurks in deep water channels? "Sharks," I said. He nodded at my perspicacity. "So imagine it. You're miles out to sea, stranded because the company you've entrusted your life to has forgotten you. You're tired. You're swimming towards a coral outcrop, and it's hard going because the tide is coming in. The light is fading, and you look around and see fins circling you. Maybe half a dozen of them." He gave me a moment to form a picture in my mind, then fixed me with a deadpan expression. "I don't know about you, but I think I'd ask for my money back." He laughed. "So nobody came back to rescue them?" "It was 2 days before anyone noticed they were missing," said Carmel. I turned to her in wonder. 2 days? By which time, of course, they were long gone. "Eaten by sharks," I said. She shrugged. "No way of knowing, but presumably. Anyway, they were never seen again." "Wow." We ate in thoughtful silence for a minute. Then I mentioned that every time there was an odd story in Australia, it seemed to come out of Queensland. My favorite of the moment concerned a German man, recently detained outside Cairns, who had arrived on a tourist visa in 1982 and spent the past 17 years wandering on foot through the northern deserts, living primarily off roadkill. I was also extremely partial to the story of a group of illegal immigrants who were brought from China on an old fishing boat, which dropped them in shallow water 100 yards off a beach near Cairns. They were caught when one of their members, carrying a suitcase, dripping water conspicuously from sodden trousers and squelching with every step, presented himself at a newsagent's shop and politely asked the proprietor if he would order a fleet of taxis to take him and some associates to the railroad station at Cairns. Nearly every day, it seemed, the papers had a story of arresting improbability under a Queensland dateline. Alan nodded in accord. "There's a reason for that, of course." "What's that?" I asked. "They're crazy in Queensland. Madder than cut snakes. You'll like it up there." In the morning, Alan ran me to the airport by way of his office. While he went off to hold the front page, or do whatever editors do, he left me to sit at his big desk and play in his swivel chair. When he returned, he was carrying a folder, which he passed to me. "I dug out some stuff on that American couple that disappeared. I thought it might be of use to you.
Thank you,
I said, quite touched. It should give you some tips on how not to get left on the reef. I know what a dozy bugger you are, Bryson. At the airport, he jumped out of the car and helped me haul my bag out of the trunk and said his farewells. He shook my hand. And remember what I said about watching yourself up north, he said.
Madder than cut snakes, I repeated, to show that I had been listening. Madder than a sack of them.
He smiled, then jumped back in the car, waved, and was gone.
Chapter 12.
It is possible, I suppose, to construct hypothetical circumstances in which you would be pleased to find yourself at the end of a long day in Maxville, New South Wales. Perhaps something to do with rising sea levels that left it as the only place on Earth not underwater, or maybe some disfiguring universal contagion from which it alone remained unscathed. In the normal course of events, however, it is unlikely that you would find yourself standing on its lonely main street at 6:30 on a warm summer's evening, gazing about you in an appreciative manner and thinking, "Well, thank goodness I'm here." I was in Maxville, owing to the interesting discovery that Brisbane is not 3 or 4 hours north of Sydney, as I had long and casually supposed, but the better part of a couple of days' drive. Well, if you look on the television weather map, Brisbane and Sydney are practically neighbors, their little local suns and storm clouds all but bumping on the chart. But in Australia, neighborliness is, of course, a relative concept. In fact, it is almost 1,000 kilometers from Sydney to Brisbane, much of it along a cheerfully pokey two-lane road. And so, in mildly confounded consequence, I was in Maxville for the night. I don't wish to disparage a community that 2,811 people proudly call home, and what a miraculous notion that is. But as I had rather had it in mind that I would be dining on fresh-caught barramundi and watching a sunset emblazon the Pacific on Queensland's storied Gold Coast, rather than stuck in an obscure backwater barely halfway there, my disappointment was real. My immediate preoccupation was that I was running out of time on this trip. I had a commitment of long-standing to take part in a fundraising hike in Syria and Jordan for a British children's charity. In 3 days I was to fly home from Sydney to collect hiking gear and see how many of my children still recognized me, before flying off again to London and onward to Damascus. It was clear that I wasn't going to see as much of the northern reaches of the Boomerang Coast as I had hoped. So my mood, as I strolled into town from my motel, was, let us say, restrained. Maxville wasn't so bad, really. Set on the bank of the swift and muddy Nambuka River, it was essentially just a pause in the highway, a tentacle of neatly gardened bungalows and small office buildings leading to a very compact town center. Though the road through town is the Pacific Highway, the main artery connecting Sydney and Brisbane, only 2 cars passed as I followed its dusty margin into town. At the heart of the modest community stood the large and fading Nambuka Hotel, and I stepped in, glad to escape the heat. It was a roomy place, but nearly empty. 2 older guys in tank tops and battered bush hats propped up one end of the long bar. In a side room, a man and a woman sat in silent absorption amid the soft mechanical glow of pokey machines. I procured a beer, stood long enough to establish that no one was going to take any interest in me that might lead to a conversation, and retired to the central portion of the bar, where I parked myself on a stool and idly watched the evening news on a silent TV mounted on the wall. Somewhere, police were out in the bush with a pack of straining sniffer dogs. There was no telling what the dogs were looking for, though if it was red clay soil, they were doing extremely well. Somewhere else there appeared to be a fresh outbreak of Ross River fever, yet another previously unknown malady for me to worry about. Then there was Paul Keating, the former Prime Minister, he of the deeply expressive vocabulary, as you may recall from Canberra, standing on the steps of an office building, answering questions from reporters and looking testy. It was impossible to determine what he was saying, but I imagined he was telling all those present that they were nongs and maggots. I decided I quite liked watching the news with the sound off. Meanwhile, back in the known world, something was happening in Kosovo. Convoys were rolling along country roads, and mortars were throwing up puffs of smoke on distant hills. Bill Clinton was in some kind of moral hot water again, or so I assumed, because he was shown strolling through the Rose Garden, holding hands with Hillary and Chelsea, all of them looking mutually devoted. They had a lovable spaniel with them as well, which I took as a sign that the president had been very bad indeed. It hardly mattered. It all seems